Hi, this is Sarah Nairfield from sarahnairfield.com. I'm coming to you today from the beautiful island of Penang in Malaysia, and I can hear birds chirping and motorbikes zooming around, so I apologize if the sound quality isn't as wonderful as I might like it to be, but hopefully either you won't hear it or it will add to the atmosphere. But today I want to talk about frugal and effective book promotion. How to avoid the halfway home of books. Book promotion, of course, is important, but here's why. For many years, I enjoyed book shopping at a big warehouse near my home. It was a kind of halfway house in between the shelves of a bookstore that we writers always dream of and the great metal teeth of a book shredder, the stuff of nightmares. I loved buying books from a warehouse for several reasons. Firstly, many of the titles weren't there because they were bad, but because they hadn't been promoted well. When the retail landscape was dominated by the big box stores all pushing the same 10 books, the warehouse offered a veritable treasure trove of relatively unknown titles for me to discover. Secondly, the price was right. As anyone who knows me or who has read my finance-related blog Enrich Mentality knows, I'm definitely a frugal person. And in Australia, where the recommended retail price for a new hardcover can be $39.99 or more, being able to buy books at approximately the same cost the rest of the world enjoys them for is an enormous boon. Finally, I imagine that I was rescuing these books from those great metal teeth, from becoming literal pulp fiction. And as it turns out, I wasn't that far off the mark. That's the dark side of having your book on shelves. For anyone aiming to become an author, the statistics on what happens to books once they hit the shelves aren't all that rosy. You might think the hard part is over once you've finally gotten an agent and/or editor interested enough to offer you a contract, or once you've gotten to the stage of hitting publish on your platform of choice. But the frugal book promoter, How to Get Nearly Free Publicity on Your Own or Partnering with Your Publisher, points out that around a third of all traditionally published books that make it into the bookstore shelves are returned to the publishers. They're then remaindered in warehouses of the kind that I used to frequent, or when that fails, they're shredded. As the author Carolyn Howard Johnson plainly puts it, if you don't promote yourself and your book early, the same thing or something like it could happen to your book. So how can we avoid having our books land in the halfway house? Or worse, in the shredder? Marketing, promoting, publicizing, advertising, branding. Creating a platform or developing public relations. Whatever you call it, marketing is something many authors have an aversion to, if not a downright fear of, and myriad excuses to avoid. Howard Johnson covers many of these excuses and offers rational antidotes to them in the introductory section 1 of her book, Getting Started and Getting On With It. As writers or creatives generally, Howard Johnson points out that many of us suffer from the fear of being successful as much as from the fear of being rejected. We worry if we promote our work, people may not like it. And if you're in this boat, I really recommend reading The Courage to be Disliked. Alternatively, though, or even at the same time perhaps, we may worry that our work will be too successful. Many of us see marketing our work as antithetical to the creative process. We feel like sellouts, fakes. Others among us feel that book promotion simply isn't our job, that marketing is something the publisher should do. The idea that marketing isn't an author's job is grounded in the reality that most writers aren't trained publicists. Yet even when a publisher does assign a publicist to an author or a book, as Howard Johnson points out, their efforts will be much better rewarded if the author is proactive. A publisher's publicist, she says, can only do so much without an author's cooperation. Although most of us know this, we often still harbour those romantic images of hermit-like authors holed up in cabins in the woods, emerging just once a year to mail off another masterpiece in a brown paper package, which the publisher gratefully receives and dutifully advertises to all and sundry. But sadly, unlike the all-too-real great metal teeth of the shredders, this notion appears to be pure fantasy, especially in today's publishing landscape of profit-driven publishing conglomerates. Writers' woes. The internet has been abuzz lately with one particular tale of writerly woe, Heather Dimitrios' viral and oft-republished article on how she lost well over a third of $1 million that she'd received in book advances. In her article, Dimitrios complains about the lack of guidance and support that she received from anyone and everyone in the publishing process. Her agent, her editor, her publisher, and even later, her MFA teachers, when it comes to two specific areas, marketing and finances. Like many a traditionally published author, Dimitrios was disappointed by her publisher's lack of marketing push for the YA books that she wrote for them. So, understandably, she decided to take matters into her own hands, creating book-related swag, and paying for an expensive website which, she laments, nobody told her she didn't need. The writerly lifestyle. Combined with her predilection for $15 cocktails and extensive travel, Dimitrios' book promotion efforts, she says, left her with a pile of debt and sales figures which, while many of us might dream of, were still not enough to earn out the above-average advances she'd received. This left her ineligible to earn royalties on her existing work, as well as making her less likely to be considered for such high advances in the future. This, of course, was a problem, given that she'd come to rely on advances much larger than average in order to support the writerly lifestyle that she, and let's face it, most of us, had dreamed of. A warning to writers. Dimitrios' article appears intended as a warning to other writers, and I think it achieves that. We could all do with taming our expectations, with learning to manage our own finances, with taking personal responsibility for the money we receive. But in reading her article, I couldn't help but think how much authors like Dimitrios, and I'm sure many others, might benefit from reading The Frugal Book Promoter, a book which, in its first edition, was originally subtitled How to Do What Your Publisher Won't Do. I recently tweeted my appreciation for this book, saying, I read an earlier edition of this book, cover to cover, twice, and it remains one of the most comprehensive and best I've come across. When the author, Carolyn Howard Johnson, whose Twitter handle is @frugalbookpromo, got in touch and offered me a copy of the updated edition, I was overjoyed to accept her kind offer. So, how might a frugal approach to book promotion help? Great expectations. Dimitrios is far from alone in expecting her publisher to market her books more aggressively. It's a sentiment that many readers of The Frugal Book Promoter likely relate to, and a misconception that even Howard Johnson herself once suffered. She says, and I quote, "Back in 2003, when I was still labouring under the misconception that big presses give big marketing budgets to new writers, Poets and Writers reported Writers E.Z. Packer's publisher, Riverhead Press, banked on name recognition when they sent her on a 10-city tour, something that her publisher's publicist maintained was a rare occurrence for a first-time author. That implied that if Packer hadn't already built a platform of her own, Riverhead wouldn't have bothered spending that kind of money on her book. The idea that, without a platform, a publisher might not give you every opportunity to make money from them was astonishing, and still is." Real-world publishing and book promotion. Yet, as the authors of Author, Publisher, Entrepreneur, Guy Kawasaki and Sean Welch explain, publishing simply doesn't work the way most of us imagine. They say, after 3 months of haranguing anyone you can get on the phone at your publisher, you come to two realizations. First, you are the primary person responsible for the marketing of your book. Second, publishers don't use marketing to cause books to sell well. They help books that are already selling well to sell even better. To use a pyromaniac analogy, publishers are accelerants, not sparks. It seems nonsensical, or as Howard Johnson puts it, astonishing, that publishers wouldn't do everything in their power to help sell the books they publish. At least until we consider the fact that for publishers, it's all a gamble. The big gamble. Around 250,000 books are published every year in the US alone. Not copies, I'm talking about titles. Yet the average American will only read, and of course not necessarily purchase, 12 books in any given year. So what are the chances of your book being amongst those the average reader picks up? They're probably even smaller than the figures above suggest, because even that average of 12 is inflated by the avid readers, such as myself and probably you too. Some people don't read at all. The most frequently reported number of books read in Pew's research was just 4, and more than a quarter of American adults read no books at all. Even worse, the readers who are reading 4 books a year are probably all reading the same 4 books as everyone else. This is why there's such a long tail in publishing, whereby a tiny handful of books sell millions of copies: Harry Potter, The Da Vinci Code, The Kite Runner, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and the rest sell hardly any. Let's imagine a world for a moment in which everything is equal. Every year, every American, 15 years of age and older, reads 12 books. If they purchased every book they read, which wouldn't happen, but then some books get purchased and never read, so let's be generous and assume 12 books bought per person, then that would be 3.18 billion books sold. Now let's assume that Americans are very diverse in their tastes, don't follow trends, and are immune to book promotion and marketing. Every book published in the US could, in this magical fair world, expect to sell around 12,720 copies. Yes, they might sell copies overseas too, but equally English language writers elsewhere can market their work in the States as well, so let's call it a wash. How does this compare to reality, specifically in Demetrius's field of young adult? According to Hannah Holt's informative survey, the average sales of a debut YA novel published by a large house was 22,000 copies. By small houses which gave an advance, this figure drops to 7,800. And by small houses that did not offer an advance, just 2,000 copies are sold. In what we might lovingly refer to as the real world, the vast bulk of sales go to those blockbuster novels. Take Lord of the Rings as an example, the book, not the series. In the 60 years between 1955 and 2015, it is estimated to have sold 150 million copies. That's 2.5 million copies a year, or almost 200 times what we might expect the average book to sell if all books sold equally well. For every Lord of the Rings, there are at least 199 less popular books which earn very little or nothing at all. And that is what we call the long tail. While writing might be all about words, publishing is a numbers game. If you were a publisher, which do you think would be more profitable? Publisher A has a stable of 200 authors. They take their entire book promotion budget and divide it by 200, giving all 200 authors the same level of promotion and support. Publisher B also has a stable of 200 authors, which they use to test the waters. Once they see which book or books have started to build momentum, they throw all their weight behind that book. The fact is, we live in a capitalist world, and it doesn't take a financial whiz to figure out that while Publisher A's model sounds more fair and is more representative of the kind of world I would like to live in, Publisher B's strategy is the one which most companies, publishers or not, use to test and refine their product offerings in our capitalist world. Because even if publisher A's authors compete nicely amongst one another and sell comparable numbers of books, there will always be other publishing companies out there, like publisher B, who are looking for the blockbusters that every single book-buying adult in America or wherever will buy. They're not interested if your book looks like it might just be part of the long tail. Those books that only avid readers like us pick up. In other words, they aren't interested in the 99.9% of books. And it's not just book promotion. For many of those books that fall into the long tail, and that's the vast majority of books, even those that sell well above average, just not at blockbuster levels, it's not just book promotion that traditional publishers are dropping the ball on. Big publishers have slashed their budgets for most books to the point that they're skimping on other essentials too, like thorough editing, proofing, typesetting, formatting, and cover design. I've lost count of the number of Big Five published ebooks that I've read in the last few months, in which characters' names have been inconsistently capitalized, punctuation has been missing or doubled in places, and words have been missing or mistaken. Some of the non-fiction books I've attempted to read have been essentially unreadable, with graphs so poorly laid out they refuse to fit on any screen, and incorrectly indexed footnotes. Increasingly, editing costs, just like marketing costs, are being pushed back onto authors. Howard Johnson even recommends authors seek out the help of a professional editor on their own terms, because, as she says, many publishers have cut their editing budgets, and you'll be more assured that the job is well done enough for you to have your book qualify for an award this way. Why, it's the quick and the dead. Carolyn Howard Johnson says, "You want to boot your book up the bestseller lists and keep it there. You want to earn back your advance and draw down even more in royalties. You can't count on your publisher. Publishers focus on their next big profit maker when sales of your book dwindle. In their pursuit of blockbusters, publishers have come to ignore all books that fail to immediately ignite," as Kawasaki and Welch put it. From a purely financial point of view, this is understandable. A single blockbuster author doesn't require as much work and support as 200 less popular ones. Even James Patterson's team at Hatchet Book Group reportedly consists of only 16 full-time staff. If those 16 staffers' efforts were spread out across 200 different authors, they would have to handle 12.5 authors each, leaving them just shy of 2 workdays per month to focus on each individual author's work. And that simply isn't enough to produce the kind of unique, innovative book promotion which might catapult a not-already-on-fire author to success. No matter how wonderful your editor or agent or publisher, nobody cares about your book as much as you do. This is where our own book promotion has to come into play, traditionally published or not. The fact is, whether we are indies or traditionally published, with a Big Five publisher or a small press, the vast majority of us aren't a Patterson or a Tolkien. Even an author who, like Demetrios, receives the kind of advances that the rest of us might dream of, can wind up feeling disappointed, abandoned, and unsupported. Ultimately, we are all in this together, and rather than engaging in book bigotry and worrying about who got the biggest advances and whose publisher is more prestigious or who has the best agent, we should focus on promoting our work. It's not just about frugal, but strategic, ethical book promotion. In section 2, Plunging In, Publicity Basics Now, Howard Johnson walks writers through the basics of PR and marketing, starting with the 3 P's of platform, publicity, and public relations. Having worked not only as a retailer and journalist, but also as a publicist and with a publicist for the release of her own novel, This Is the Place, Carolyn Howard Johnson is better placed than most to write a book about book promotion. She recommends that we pick and choose ideas from her book, stating that only someone who had no guidance, like me, in the days right after my novel was published, would attempt to use them all. But how is a new author to avoid this temptation to try everything? Later in the book, Howard Johnson suggests that we focus on the media we know best. These, she says, we will have the best idea of how to pitch to or leverage. Although Howard Johnson's book advocates a frugal approach to promotion, it does not claim that every effective promotion is free. Instead, the author explains clearly how writers can use their time instead of their money to promote their books, as well as giving examples of when spending is warranted and when it offers little. Website design, for example, can be largely DIY with the free yet professional quality tools that Howard Johnson recommends, and promotional gifts or swag, with the exception of quality thank you gifts, she also warns against. As she says, how many coffee mugs that celebrate your favorite authors do you own? Rock stars, we are not. Learning from others. By looking for free, inexpensive, and most importantly, cost-effective methods of book promotion, rather than just shelling out for whatever swag we think will look cool on Instagram or whatever expensive website we think might look impressive, sticking to a budget can force us to think outside the box and come up with some truly unique ideas. Ultimately, there is a lot that I disagree with in Demetrius' stance regarding publishing and finance. Traditional publishers are not the gatekeepers of quality we often wish they were. When looking for advice, whether an author is traditionally or independently published, or both, it doesn't matter to me as much as whether I admire their work. Nor do I believe that it's a publisher's responsibility to help authors manage their finances any more than it was Demetrius' duty to provide financial counselling to the developer she presumably contracted to design her website. That being said, I absolutely applaud her bravery for speaking out about some of the mistakes that she made. And that is no easy thing to do, even though it is immensely useful for the rest of us. In their book, Yes, Noah Goldstein, Steve Martin, and Robert Cialdini referred to the research of Wendy Zhong and colleagues who examined the effects of two different kinds of firefighter training. One group of firefighters was given case studies in which poor decisions led to negative outcomes. Meanwhile, the other was given examples in which firefighters avoided negative consequences through good decision-making, what is often referred to in the business world as best practice. The group exposed to the examples of mistakes ultimately did better, and I think that the same is likely true of us writers. In sharing her personal experience of living the dream and then finding out that it's not all it's cracked up to be, Demetrios has given aspiring and new writers some very valuable information. Dreams versus reality. While it might be easy for us to criticize the decisions of others, especially when we wish that we were lucky enough to have a publisher pick up our work, let alone throw hundreds of thousands of dollars at it, Demetrios' case is a useful warning to us all. And I have to imagine that it's not all that unusual either. At least 20% of the YA books in Hannah Holt's survey never earned out their advances. In total, half of the authors in her survey responded that they earned less than $10,000 from their writing in the previous year. And before you think, oh, they were probably indies or they were probably at small presses, it's important to note that over 60% of the authors in the study were published by the Big Five publishers. It's also easy for us to imagine that receiving a large sum of money will solve all of our financial woes. But as I've blogged about before, evidence from the real world tends to point in the opposite direction. Lottery winners are actually twice as likely to go bankrupt as those who've never won. The publishing lottery. Although Demetrius is frequently comparing the writing experience to other jobs like corporate work or teaching in her article, traditional publishing is a vastly different beast. In some respects, we might be better off thinking of it as a lottery. Not just from the publisher's point of view, as I've already explained, but from the writer's perspective too. Now, this isn't to say that I don't believe there is any skill involved on the author's part. Of course, your idea and your writing itself must be sufficiently accomplished in order to attract a publisher. Unless, of course, you're already a celebrity in your own right And then they'll offer you a wheelbarrow full of money to slap your name on a book that somebody else writes. But there absolutely is a big whack of luck involved. Your zombie manuscript, for example, can be rejected even if it's better, simply because the publisher signed one last week and they don't want them competing. Your cookbook might be the best one in its class, but no publisher will touch it if that particular diet fad is over. And your book might be rejected simply because some YouTube star has promised that they'll write a book about literally nothing. And then, of course, there's the biggest lottery of them all, what Warren Buffett rightly calls the ovarian lottery. That is, where you are born and in what circumstances will have an enormous impact on not only your own education and access to technology to write, but on how relatable and relevant and ultimately publishable agents will find your manuscript. We relate easiest to those most similar to ourselves. It's worth bearing in mind, as the fantastic book Under the Cover points out, the area of agents is absolutely saturated with white female literary agents who often, unintentionally, wind up privileging manuscripts which explore white female experiences or which translate so-called exotic experiences through a lens which is accessible to white, often upper-middle-class American females. In contrast to the almost 800 literary agents fitting this description in the US, a black male author in 2015 had only 2 black male literary agents they could send their manuscript to, in the hopes of one connecting with their manuscript due to a shared experience or perception of a shared experience of being a black male in the United States. Risk. Traditional publishing requires that authors take risks. This is another reason I consider it like gambling. Most fiction writers don't get paid a dime until they've written the whole book. But publishers are taking a risk too. When they pay an indie author an advance on their royalties, they're betting that the book will earn at least enough to cover that sum, and then, hopefully, some more. But often, that doesn't happen. In 2013, according to Weinberg's survey of over 3,000 authors cited in Under the Cover, only 14% of contract-published authors made more than $60,000 from their book. Another lucky 24% of contract-published writers reported earning between $20,000 and $59,999. But the vast majority are fortunate if they make even minimum wage at their writing. 22% of authors reported earning between $5,000 and $19,999, and the most common category of earnings was just $1 to $4,999, with 34% of authors who have contracts with publishing companies falling into this category. And then, and this might surprise you, a whole 6% reported making no income from their work at all. This means that more than 1 in 20 authors with a publishing contract got $0. Is it any wonder, then, that so many books fail to earn out? Much of the success of a book does come down to luck, or at least timing. We need to be lucky enough to find the right agent and publisher where relevant, lucky enough to hit the shelves at the right time. The only way that we can improve the odds are through persistence and promotion. Investing savvy versus luck. It might seem depressing that so many of our successes as authors are attributable to the factors other than our quality of work. But there is a lot that we can do to increase the odds in our favour. These days, most of the Big Five, who, along with their various imprints, make up the vast bulk of the publishing industry, appear to be taking what I would consider a short-term trading approach instead of a long-term investment mindset. The supply of writers who want to be published authors is virtually inexhaustible, and as access to education and technology improve, this is likely to increase. Meanwhile, books are competing for leisure time along various media unknown even just 2 decades ago, and while people do still read, the number of books they read appears to be decreasing. This means it's a buyer's market. The situation is great for publishers and readers who have more choice of authors and books than ever before. But the opposite is true for authors who must clamour to be heard in a crowded market and who, on the whole, are treated with what I would describe as contempt by publishers too busy to acknowledge their existence, just like job seekers in a depression. Fortunately, though, there is an alternative to the model offered by traditional publishing, where gatekeepers are primarily interested in making a quick buck, it seems. No illusions. Indie publishing, on the other hand, is much less like a lottery. Independent authors might have grand dreams for their work, but they're under no illusions that their publisher will sweep in with a marvelous, innovative, killer book promotion plan and push their title to the front of the shelves and the top of the charts. Indie authors know that they, personally, have to really hustle to be successful. Successful indies know, as Howard Johnson points out, that publishing necessarily involves marketing. My analysis of indie authors' social media engagement versus that of traditionally published authors illustrates this. The indie author may not receive an advance like a traditionally published one, although, as Demetrius's case shows, unless well spent, just like lottery winnings, this may not be a real advantage in any case. Instead, a successful author might earn a trickle, which hopefully one day will become a steady flow of money over time. The sad reality is the odds are stacked against indie authors too. Almost a fifth of self-published authors reported making no money at all. The vast bulk, or 63%, make between $1,000 and $4,999. And that leaves only single digits of self-published authors making it into the higher echelons of earnings. 9% earn between $5,000 and $19,999. 5% earn between $20,000 and $59,999. And just 4% earn over $60,000. Seeing as these are self-reports, it's likely that the real situation for both indie and traditionally published authors is even less rosy, because of course few of us like to brag that our books have earned nothing or very little. So while this picture isn't particularly rosy for traditional authors and is even less so for indies, there is one big advantage that the indie author has, and that is complete transparency and a greater degree of control. While I have yet to publish any fiction myself, I'll be making an announcement about my forthcoming novel Number 8 Crispy Chicken very soon though, I have published several non-fiction books in the past. When I self-published my book about name changes, You Stole My Heart, Do I Have to Take Your Name, earlier this year, as a way of dipping my toe into the waters of self-publishing, having previously only published through academic presses, I was astounded by the level of control and oversight that I had. As someone on the other side of the planet purchased my copy, immediately I could see that information flash across my screen. With traditional publishing, I only ever knew how many copies of my book had sold when I received a royalty check. Indie publishing gives us the data in real time that we need to analyze our efforts, to figure out what worked and what didn't. Purchasing 500 bobble-headed figurines of my protagonist, did it boost sales enough to cover the exorbitant costs involved? Has signing up for that expensive book promotion mailing list that spruiks my book about gourmet cooking for cats paid off? Is anyone who clicks on my Facebook ads actually purchasing anything? Data, of course, only becomes information if we analyze it. If we have access to all of these numbers but don't put in place a way of measuring and assessing our efforts, we are no better off than the traditionally published author who is kept in the dark and fobbed off with excuses of the kind that Demetrios kept hearing from her publisher. So, what can authors do? Over the past year, I've read or sampled close to 100 books on marketing and book promotion in particular. Most are variations on the same theme. They say, use the internet, social media, or the big one, newsletters, to sell your books. Many promise to explain the one secret trick to book promotion, which often involves the purchase or subscription to some proprietary service best-selling authors mysteriously seem to do without. Yet few, if any, have advice for thinking outside the box when it comes to finding media opportunities that perfectly suit your book. And often, these can be even more powerful. In my genre, I recently saw an indie book published to great success, despite its very narrow audience, satirizing a very specific career, precisely because, I think, it targeted likely readers through industry newsletters and groups. Think outside, or maybe inside, the box. Aside from its focus on frugality, another standout feature of Howard Johnson's book is its inclusion of classic media, such as newspapers, television, and radio. While the Frugal Book Promoter also provides extensive information on new media, like author websites, blogging, and social media, the advice in these sections may read as if it's targeting an older audience, one that perhaps needs convincing that having a website is worthwhile, for example, as opposed to a younger audience which might actually need convincing to stop scrolling through social media all day and actually write something. By all means, if you're interested in promoting your book and not going into debt to do so, make sure you read The Frugal Book Promoter. The Frugal Book Promoter is chock full of book promotion ideas that don't cost much and many that don't cost anything at all. The book comes with extensive appendices, sample query letters for agents, editors, radio, magazine, and newspapers, sample media releases for events and the publication of your books. There are sample blog posts and invitations for trade show appearances, a sample script for a phone pitch even, and sample automated email signature, and even a sample tip sheet. You'll also find an annotated bibliography and extensive reference list. And the book is indexed, which is something I really appreciate, human indexing remaining superior to the find function. If you are interested in learning more about marketing with me, or you just love books, especially with a social justice bent, then please join my street team. You'll find all the details for that, as well as the links to Carolyn Howard Johnson's wonderful book, The Frugal Book Promoter, on my website, sarahnearfield.com.